This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, the big tech earnings are starting to come in. We'll take a look at what to expect from Netflix. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
And I'm Roger Hearing in London, where we're looking ahead to the ECB's first policy meeting of the year and an impending strategy review.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, looking ahead to an unprecedented event, an impeachment trial of a president in the middle of an election year.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Sweeping measures to clean up the world's shipping industry are driving up the cost of trade, even as they lower pollution.
And in Asia, India's Supreme Court begins a review of the government's controversial new citizenship law. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. Time to binge on a little Netflix. The streaming giant has earnings coming out next week, and Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw is with me for that. Lucas, I have heard so much about Disney Plus in recent weeks that that makes me wonder how Netflix is doing.
You know, the earliest indications out of Netflix were that Netflix was doing just fine. The fact that the churn rate, the rate at which people were dropping Netflix, had not changed in the first couple of weeks of Disney Plus. Now, that does not account for the whole third quarter, the last 3 months of the year, but it does echo what Netflix thought would happen, which was that the effect from new competition, Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus, and then coming competition from HBO Max and Peacock, would be felt more in the long term than the short term. Now, that being said, Netflix reports earnings. It's a big moment because it is the first time that they have reported since this new influx of competition. And while they might think or at least hope that there's not going to be a huge impact, we don't really know.
I know from personal experience that Netflix does have some pretty strong content right now.
Yeah, you know, this was a particularly unusual quarter for Netflix. You know, when you think of them, it started off as hosting other people's movies and TV shows, kind of reruns and old hits. Then it moved into making original TV shows. And in the past few years, it's been making more and more movies. And this was far and away its biggest quarter for that. It had Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. It had Michael Bay's Six Underground. It had Dolomite Is My Name, starring Eddie Murphy. It had Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. It had a movie that came from the TV show Breaking Bad. And on top of that, it did have a new season of The Crown, which is a very popular TV show. So if Netflix had a very strong end to the year, it was likely because of that type of content. Now, what we don't know is what the effect of movies are on or is on Netflix's subscriber base. Netflix isn't even sure of that. Its executives have said that this final quarter was a little more difficult to predict because they don't know how original movies both affect whether people are going to sign up and whether they just sign up for a second and cancel right away.
Well, since you mentioned The Irishman and Marriage Story, it certainly can't hurt that they've both been nominated for Academy Awards.
Yeah, Netflix got two pictures nominated for Best Picture, which is the first time that that's happened. It had the most nominations of any movie studio. You know, that is attention that should draw more people to the platform. You know, it's been a big part of the Netflix strategy to compete for awards because of the halo effect, both with viewers and with talent who then want to come to work at Netflix. Now, the question, of course, is the Oscars, though it is globally known, is really a U.S. event. And the focus for Netflix, by and large, now is overseas. You know, they project that they're going to add 7.6 million customers in the final 3 months of the year. You know, more than 6 million of those will come from international if they hit that number. But every little bit counts, and the fact that U.S. growth has been slowing, maybe having a couple of Best Picture nominees will offset that in the short term.
Let me take you back to Disney Plus. How much of a direct threat or direct competition is Disney Plus to Netflix?
My my sense, just from talking to a lot of experts and from having covered the streaming space for a long time, is that it will undoubtedly compete for attention. When people moved from watching TV, kind of live TV from their cable and satellite operator to the internet, they did it in large part because of Netflix and to a lesser extent YouTube. And while Netflix has had competition in the form of Amazon and Hulu, Disney Plus seems like the most formidable competitor that it's had thus far, just because of Disney's skill in making its shows and its kind of library of very well-known titles, Marvel, Star Wars, Pixar, and so on. But if you do believe that TV viewing is moving in total, other than maybe news and live sports, from the live cable environment to this on-demand environment, most people are going to subscribe and watch multiple services. And so I think that it will compete for attention, and it could hurt Netflix in terms of future growth. I've never really been a subscriber to the idea that Netflix is going to lose customers en masse because they're just going to cancel Netflix for Disney Plus. Not to say it won't happen, it just seems unlikely because most data suggests that people will pay for anywhere from 3 to 5 services. One thing that you could see, and I got this from a veteran executive in this space, is as there are more different options, you could see people cycle between, because it's very easy to cancel a Netflix or a Disney Plus, much easier than it was to cancel cable or to cancel individual channels on cable. So maybe somebody will sign up for Netflix for 2 months to watch The Crown and The Irishman, and that comes after The Mandalorian. But then when Disney Plus has something next year, they'll cancel Netflix and sign up for Disney Plus. This is still a new enough phenomenon that we can't have certainty in sort of user behavior.
I don't know. You need the Baby Yoda fix, I think.
Baby Yoda definitely helps.
All right. Thank you very much, Lucas. That was Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a big week next week for the ECB. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Up later in our program, a look at what to expect as the rich and famous gather for the annual confab in Davos, Switzerland. But first, we check in with our bureau in Europe about what's happening at the European Central Bank with Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchors Caroline Hepker and Roger Hearing.
Bob, the ECB president sent a letter to policymakers about discussing the strategy review and has also asked for open minds on the matter.
Well, for more, we're joined by Bloomberg's European economy editor Jana Randow and also our senior euro area economist David Powell. Great to have you on the programme. So Christine Lagarde told the press conference last month that she's planning to start this review in the course of January. So what might that cover? Jana?
So first and foremost, they will look at the inflation goal itself. Right now, below but close to 2%. It's quite difficult to explain. There have been voices here and there to say, well, should we settle at 2% with some flexibility around? They're very keen on establishing that the goal is symmetrical. So there will be a big discussion about the inflation goal as such. But there will also be discussion about climate change, about digital currencies, about the tools the ECB uses. So what we should really expect to be all-encompassing.
Okay, David, let me pick up on that notion about the inflation target. There have been comments from a number of ECB policymakers. What's the drift as to what might or could happen?
There's not only that issue that Jana brought up of what exactly the target is. There's also the issue of how is it measured. Mm. So is CPI inflation the right thing to be looking at? And that's what Benoît Cœuré brought up just before he retired from the ECB in December. There's also the role of inflation expectations, which he said they should look at. Different measures of inflation expectations point to different things. Should I be looking at what the markets expect or what businesses expect and households expect? So there's a lot wrapped up in that inflation question, which is going to be their primary focus in this review, though, as Jana said, it will look at climate change, monetary policy implementation, and other aspects of their jobs.
Mm, okay, so this is the big picture, obviously, the start of a new presidency, really, or the infancy of a new presidency, and the start of a new year. But let's get down also to brass tacks, and actually, are they going to do anything just at this meeting? Of course, we've had the latest Eurozone data suggest perhaps that the worst may be over for European manufacturers. Unemployment is close to a record low, but then inflation crept up in December. So, David, just run us through the latest economic data, sort of away from the big picture. What might they actually do at this meeting, if anything?
Well, the answer to that is very little. Economic data have essentially said things are kind of just going along as they were before. There are no big changes from the last meeting. Probably the biggest thing that's happening in the Eurozone is that these global trade tensions are calming down a little bit. We have a measure of uncertainty in the economy that we've created, and it shows that uncertainty is coming down. That's good for economic growth. Businesses have more clarity about what next year will look like. So while we expect, and the latest survey suggests that in the last quarter of the year, the economy grew at the same pace as the third quarter, 0.2, we might see a small bit of improvement in the first quarter, and that will provide the ECB with the luxury of focusing on longer-term issues, as they essentially don't have to do anything on monetary policy right now or in the foreseeable future.
Our thanks there to senior Euro area economist David Powell and also to Bloomberg's European economy editor, Jana Randow. I'm Roger Hearing.
And I'm Caroline Hepker here in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London, 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
All right, thank you, guys. And now let's head to India, where a controversial law is rattling nerves. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia host Brian Curtis is tracking developments from our Hong Kong bureau. Brian?
Bob, in the next week, India's Supreme Court will begin a review of the government's controversial new citizenship law. Now, this law has sparked weeks of demonstrations and a police crackdown, and more than a dozen people have died in the protests. The new law bars undocumented Muslims from neighboring countries, including Pakistan and Bangladesh, from seeking citizenship in India. It allows people with other religious beliefs to do so. The law is called the Citizenship Amendment Act, and it has been decried by many. Microsoft boss Satya Nadella is one. He said what is happening is sad. Joining us now to understand more about this, and particularly the process of the review in the Supreme Court, is Bloomberg's Archana Chowdhury. Archana, now critics say that this is a violation of the Constitution. Walk us through exactly what will the court's approach be to this review.
Right on top, we need to mention that India is a secular country, and our constitution is decidedly for, you know, holds every religion, every citizen equal before law. Now, this is the first time that in the history of India, independent India since 1947, that we have a government that has come out with a law that says that only excludes a particular religion. It excludes Muslims from this particular, you know, from seeking citizenship in India, which is something that violates the Article 14 of our Constitution. And so we are expecting that is what will come up before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will look at it as whether this is a violation of that particular article and whether this law then holds, because we're hoping that we will basically get to redefine and agree once again on the fact that, you know, I mean, the whole protests on the streets have been about basically this, that you cannot keep out one group of citizens, because this law is supposed to be followed by something called a National Citizens Registry. So essentially what the National Citizens Registry will do is that it will turn around and it will ask people, you know, for their citizenship documents. If Hindus and Sikhs or Jains or the other religions in India, even Christians, they find that these religions, people from these religions don't have these documents, they can use the CAA to basically get their citizenship. But the Muslims will not be able to do that.
It's a process to enable refugees in India to get citizenship and to have that formalized, that process. And that would help them in order to get into educational institutions, to get jobs and buy property. But it's backfired, has it not?
It has backfired tremendously, because people can see the malice behind this particular, you know, law. There was no need really for this law. It's unprecedented.
All right, Archana, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. Bloomberg's Archana Chowdhury. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner on the program. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia. It begins at 7 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
All right, thank you, Brian. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we go to our Washington Bureau for a look at what's next in the impeachment saga with our Nathan Hager. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. And one of the biggest is likely to be the impeachment process. For more on that, we go to Washington and the host of Bloomberg Daybreak, Nathan Hager. Nathan.
Thanks, Bob. Washington is preparing for a moment that has only come twice before in the nation's history, an impeachment trial of an American president. A team of seven Democrats, led by House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff, will make the case to the Republican-controlled Senate that President Trump deserves to be removed from office for putting political pressure on Ukraine.
We feel the weight of history. We feel that we are carrying out the will of the framers of our Constitution, and that's a pretty serious load to carry.
And Bloomberg News will have a deep bench of reporters and editors covering this Senate trial, including Congressional Editor Anna Edgerton, who joins me now. Thanks for being here, Anna. So are you gearing up for a long trial or a short one? Because depending on which party you talk to, we might get a different answer.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be a matter of weeks, and it's definitely a historic moment, but it is kind of become a symbolic thing because, you know, we don't really expect the president to be removed from office at the end of this, just because you need a two-thirds majority to actually remove the president from office, which would mean you would need at least 20 Republican senators to turn against the president and vote to convict him of these charges that the House will be presenting. So it will definitely be a big symbolic moment. It's definitely a historical thing in the Capitol building, but it doesn't look like it's really going to alter the course of American history. We're probably looking at a trial of about 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks.
2, 3, maybe 4 weeks. What is dependent on whether we see a short trial or a long trial? What are you looking for?
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants a short trial. He wants to acquit the president as quickly as possible and get on with the rest of the Senate's business and move on. But Democrats have insisted that additional witnesses should be called and that new documents should be introduced as evidence, especially looking for the testimony of people like John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor. There could be Republicans that vote with Democrats to call these witnesses. The big question now is who else they would call. Some Republicans have suggested that if they call John Bolton, for example, they should also call Hunter Biden, the son of the former vice president, who was also involved in some of these Ukraine allegations that were being investigated by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani.
And when you talk about the possibility of more witnesses coming forward, not only does that raise the question of whether we're going to see a prolonged trial, but whether it sort of spirals out in terms of the focus.
One of the big reasons why Democrats want additional witnesses is because so many of the witnesses that they requested and even subpoenaed, and so many of the documents that they requested from the Trump administration were not provided. The Trump administration gave very clear directions to current and former officials to not participate in the House proceedings. So the fact that they went forward with the case that they had, they did not want to wait for a court process to play out to enforce subpoenas. They had pretty solid evidence from a bunch of current and former State Department officials to kind of outline the president's actions regarding Ukraine, but they didn't have anyone in his inner circle because those are the people who refuse to testify. So if the Senate is able to actually call some of those people in, that could change the story, put the story a bit closer to the president himself.
And since the House impeachment inquiry itself, we've had even more added to the story, including new documents from the House Intelligence Committee, this interview that came last week with Lev Parnas, the associate of Rudy Giuliani, that seemed to be fairly damning to the president, and a a Government Accountability Office report about whether federal law was violated with the military aid to Ukraine being withheld. How could all that factor into what we see from the actual Senate trial?
At this point, it's a political process. You know, it looks like a judicial process. So there, you know, is the senators are sworn in as jurors. There are prosecutors that come from the House of Representatives. You have Chief Justice John Roberts presiding over the proceedings. But it is an inherently political process. So even if we get additional evidence, even if we get additional information introduced into the process, it probably will have the same political outcome, whether or not other Trump administration officials have to comply with subpoenas.
Bloomberg News congressional editor Anna Edgerton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Nathan Hager. Stay with Bloomberg Radio for full coverage of President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. And tune into Balance of Power with David Westin for all the latest from Washington. It airs weekdays at noon Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio and television. Bob?
All right. Thank you, Nathan. That's Bloomberg Daybreak host Nathan Hager. And you can hear Nathan weekday morning starting at 5 a.m. Wall Street time here on Bloomberg Radio. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak weekend, politicians, investors, and reporters and anchors are heading to Davos. Bloomberg surveillance anchor Tom Keene is one of them, and we'll be checking in with him next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Coming up, what actually happens at the annual gathering of influential people in Davos, Switzerland. But first, a quick look at the commodity space. 3 years ago, the United Nations put the shipping industry on notice. It was time to clean up its fuel emissions. The new IMO 2020 rules have just kicked in. Bloomberg's Daniel Bokov is looking at the impact from our Toronto bureau.
Bob, on January 1st, the vast majority of ships hauling cargo around the world were forced to switch to a cleaner fuel. They had plenty of warning, and yet the disruption has still been quite significant. There are winners and losers already emerging, and Jack Whittles joins me from London with more. Jack, it's nice to speak to you.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
This has only been in place for just a little over 2 weeks. What kind of impact is it having so far on costs?
So this has had a big impact on the cost of shipping fuel. Just to give you a bit of a flavor of that. So in Singapore, which is the world's main refueling hub, the cost of the new sort of IMO 2020 compliant fuels are about 75% more than what the old stuff currently costs. Now, the old stuff has got a bit, you know, there's less demand for it, but that's still a big increase in the cost of shipping fuel.
The UN actually announced the changes more than 3 years ago. So why is this having such a big impact? I would have thought that the industry would have had some time to adjust.
I think that the scale is the main answer to that question. So roughly, in 2019, roughly 3.8 million barrels of this old shipping fuel was burned every day. And on one day, on January the 1st, you suddenly have to flip this entire global supply chain infrastructure. So it's a massive logistical challenge. So for my money, the oil and shipping industry has actually done quite well in getting it all done pretty much in time.
This is being done, you know, for a variety of health and environmental benefits. Usually when you have some sort of a big disruption like this, there are financial beneficiaries as well. Do you have a sense of who the winners are likely to be?
In terms of the financial side, some of the shippers have installed these special units called scrubbers, which means that they can keep using the old, cheap, high-sulfur fuel that they were burning last year. And they can save a lot of money by doing that because it's so cheap now. And some of the other big financial winners are any of the refiners who can consume that old shipping fuel and get rid of it because it's so cheap and they can make money by doing that.
The United Nations could not have predicted kind of how 2020 was going to start in terms of this heightened tension that we've been seeing between the U.S. and Iran. The situation is still delicate. How much potential, though, does it have to sort of amplify the impact of the new IMO 2020 rules on fuel costs?
I mean, if the conflict in the Middle East did ratchet up and we did see some sort of limits on the amount of oil that would come out of the Strait of Hormuz, that's that key strait in the Middle East where a lot of the world's crude oil comes out of, then we could see, you know, a big spike in crude oil prices, and that would obviously feed into the cost of marine fuel. So whilst ship fuel costs have already gone up, they could go even higher if something were to happen along those lines.
Jack, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov. Bob.
All right, thank you, Bloomberg's Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Now let's turn to one of the big events of next week. Politicians, policymakers, and these days they call them influencers. They're going to a famous Swiss resort for that annual ritual called Davos. Bloomberg surveillance host Tom Keane will also be going. And tell me the truth. This is just a junket. No business gets done
it
there,
is
right?
A junket, but I'm going to defend it. This will be my 16th year, Bob Moon, I believe. I counted up. I lost count at 13, but I think it's my 16th year going up Happy Valley. It is a junket. Anyone who denies that is out of their mind. But it's changed over the years, and there were a couple C points, you know, really clarion calls. When I first went to Davos, there was a sprinkling of celebrities, or there'd be some tall, gorgeous model or Bono from U2 or whatever would show up. And there was a celebrity thing. Somebody actually came up to me my first year and said, you shouldn't be wearing a coat and tie, because it was a huge effort to be casual about it. And then they went through different iterations, including some really ugly protests, I'm going to say 6, 7, 8 years ago during the Occupy Wall Street moment as well. But the big thing that's changed that makes it not a junket is corporate officers figured out it's the one time all year where they can meet their customers and their future customers. And I'd say this to people, I say this in speeches, Davos is basically a plumber's convention for people in fancy suits. It's like the NAMM, the music conference going out in Anaheim in January every year. It's where everybody gets together, mm-hmm. and you have endless meetings behind the scenes to build and re-nurture relationships. That's what it's really become about, far less than a junket.
A lot of focus in recent years on income inequality. Are they making any progress?
Well, they're themes, and it's very important to split it into two Davoses. Each year, with huge advanced preparation by the World Economic Forum and Dr. Schwab, they come up with a theme. And they're always interesting. They're always very visceral and very immediate to what's going on. This year, without question, is about these buzzwords of purpose and being mindful about global climate change and sustainability, all the usual buzzwords. And a couple years ago, that same earnestness was there about income inequality and wealth inequality. It's not that it's not front and center. It's just been superseded this year by the overarching themes. And all of that was brought to a crescendo in recent weeks by Lawrence Fink over at BlackRock, who's really shifted to Larry Fink's credit, he's single-handedly shifted the dialogue on business thinking about global climate change and doing something about it.
Now, I started out talking about Davos as a junket, but not too many junkets attract the President of the United States. What's your sense of why he's going there?
I think that the president loves the hoopla of it, the junketness of it, the splash of it. I believe I can say this, that we have a president who's never turned down going to an affair like this. But far more, it truly gets him in front of a different audience than he sees 362 days of the year.
He sees this as his audience, right? I mean,
Sophisticated question from Bob Moon. That's a really good question. It's certainly not the audience that got Donald Trump elected president of the United States. I think he wants to participate in it within his perception of where he fits into global politics, economics, finance, and investment. How he's received is a different story. I clearly remember the last time he went a number of years ago. And, of course, security's ramped up as it is for other world leaders. And there's in the Congress Center, there's basically three wings. And there's a wing off to the side, which is a very busy wing. It's where people hide out. I know that Andrew Ross Sorkin of the New York Times on CNBC always sits at one certain desk. And I know if I need to find Andrew, I can go find him in that wing. There's that kind of thing. And the president, we were waiting for the president to come through, and it was packed with the excitement of Donald Trump being there. So whether it's Mr. Sarkozy years ago, Chancellor Merkel this year, in a conversation with Klaus Schwab, or the president's speech, and many, many others, it's a big deal when some of these people talk. And sometimes it's not a big deal. Sometimes these anticipated speeches fall flat.
Now, I have brought President Trump into the mix here to sort of meld it with what you were mentioning earlier, and that is the recent focus on climate change. Do people, you know, tug his ear about climate change?
Yes, and he doesn't listen. I mean, I don't think that's an editorial by myself. He's stated clearly where he is on climate change, and that's one of the debates here. I'll be on a sustainable panel with Bank of America. I'm thrilled that they've asked me to be on this panel, and it will be a heated discussion about the execution and the tactics to do the things we need to do. What's interesting about this is very important. This goes back to Mr. Bloomberg's effort in Paris a number of years ago. Of course, Michael Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and this radio and television platform as well. And it goes back to, okay, government's not going to do it for whatever reason. So business has to begin to think about these things. And as you know, as Mike Bloomberg says, it's about painting roofs white instead of black because the heat radiates, you know, the heat radiates away. And it's little things like that. And I would expect this year to see a Davos that's much more about what's going to take to do all these things people are talking about.
But it doesn't come to the point where Donald Trump feels uncomfortable with that topic?
I don't know if he'd admit it. I don't know if he would admit that he was uncomfortable with the topic. Now, it may come up. Usually he will dash in. He'll be sequestered in some other rooms. His entourage will wander through. My recollection is the president's entourage is very, very large. He'll go in. He'll do his speech. The entourage will shake hands for 4 minutes. Boom, he's gone. And it's helicopter to Air Force One, I'm assuming. Maybe it's in a secret location. I don't know. Let's be clear here. Airplanes really can't fly into Davos. It's truly in the mountains.
Hmm. I can't let you go without asking you this question. What are you most looking forward to in Davos this year?
It's a really important question. I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to, in that every year leading up to Davos right now, and into the weekend, and into Monday, and into Tuesday, there's this huge certitude theme. 100% of the time, the theme changes in the vicinity of Wednesday afternoon and into Thursday. Will that happen this year? And this huge mystery of what that theme will be when Davos shifts 2 and 3 days in.
All right. Thank you, Tom Keene, host of Bloomberg Surveillance. Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio from 7 to 10 a.m. Wall Street time. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Tune us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.